From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. There were reports Friday that China and Japan have reached agreement on a number of issues that have had them at loggerheads for years, including recent incidents of near misses between their respective militaries. The reports come amid an announcement that Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Chinese President Xi Jinping are likely to meet early next week in Beijing. The two governments have agreed to begin making specific arrangements for the meeting to be held on the sidelines of the summit of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. Abe is to arrive in Beijing Sunday. Japan and China have not held a formal bilateral summit since May of 2012. For more, we have this report from the Japanese news agency NHK.
Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been seeking a meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping, and he's been laying down the groundwork for the talks. He sent a senior government official to China this week for coordination. The head of National Security Secretariat, Shotaro Yachi, met with Chinese State Councilor Yang Jiechi. Japanese officials want to hold the summit without any conditions. But their Chinese counterpart said Japan should first recognize there is an issue of sovereignty over islands in the East China Sea. Japan controls the Senkaku Islands. China and Taiwan claim them. The Japanese government maintains the islands are an inherent part of Japan's territory. It says there is no issue of sovereignty to be resolved.
Some analysts say that the fact that the meeting was set means that Japan is likely open to some negotiation over the islands, which have been a stumbling block to closer ties between the two Asian giants. Among those analysts is Professor Yang Bojiang from the Institute of Japanese Studies of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. He spoke with the Chinese news agency CCTV Friday and explained what the new consensus might mean for relations between the two nations.
I think it's very, very significant. This is the first time for China, Japan, the two sides, to write down clearly for the first time the disputes over the territorial disputes over Diaoyu Islands. I think this is very, very meaningful. And also the two sides also promised to each other to jointly find out a way to build up about crisis management mechanism. Very significant.
How do you spell impunity? You might spell it ICC, as in the International Criminal Court, if you are a family or friend to a dead American peace activist named Furkan Dogan, an 18-year-old native of Troy, New York, who was the youngest of nine victims of the Israeli military attack on the unarmed peace flotilla Mavi Marmara en route to Gaza with humanitarian relief supplies in May of 2010. A report of the fact-finding mission of the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights on the Israeli attack on the Gaza flotilla found Israel responsible for, quote, grave breaches of the Fourth Geneva Convention, closed quote, and guilty of, quote, willful killing, torture, or inhumane treatment, and willfully causing great suffering or serious injury, closed quote. An autopsy revealed that the American teen had suffered five gunshot wounds to the nose, back of the head, left leg, and left ankle from a distance of about 2 feet. Furthermore, the killings of at least five of the other passengers were committed in a manner the report called, quote, consistent with arbitrary and summary execution, closed quote, which are, under international law, crimes against humanity. The report has been largely ignored in the American media. The case was referred to the ICC in May of 2013. This week, the court announced no charges would be filed. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
No criminal charges will be laid by the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court or ICC, against Israel for a raid on a Turkish-owned ship that tried to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza in 2010. 9 Turkish activists were reportedly killed when Israeli defense forces intercepted the Marie Marmara as it tried to break the blockade imposed by Israel on Gaza. The case was referred to the ICC in May 2013. Prosecutor Fatoumata Bensouda concluded that following consideration of the available information, there was a reasonable basis to believe that war crimes were committed on the Marie Marmara during the raid, but that the ICC would not take action.
However, after carefully assessing all relevant considerations, I concluded that the potential case or cases likely arising from an investigation into this incident would not be of sufficient gravity to justify further action by the court. The gravity requirement is an explicit legal criteria set by the Rome Statute.
Ms. Bensouda said that she did not minimize the impact of the alleged crimes on the victims or their families, but that she had to be guided by the Rome Statute, which directs the court. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
Friday marked the anniversary of the issuance in 1957 of the so-called Gaither Report, a 38-page document purporting to detail the military capabilities of the Soviet Union at that time. Aside from vastly overestimating the Soviet nuclear arsenal, which drove a massive U.S. buildup to close an imaginary gap in bombers, missiles, and warheads, the report said that the best thing Americans could do to protect themselves from the dangers of nuclear war was to build fallout shelters.
You need to know about fallout, what it is, how to detect it, and what to do to protect yourself against it. Everybody needs to know. Yes, this does mean you.
Despite the fact that there have been several near misses with catastrophic nuclear war over the years, the U.S., the U.K., and France still maintain massive nuclear arsenals facing towards Russia and vice versa. And despite the fact that Republicans have assailed every announcement of an intended move by the Obama administration in almost every area of government policy, they have not yet raised a word against the president's announced plans to spend hundreds of billions of dollars more on an upgrade of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. RT's Guyan Shichikayan has more.
Nuclear disarmament was once one of President Obama's main defense policy goals. It was his vision of a nuclear-free world that the Nobel Committee cited when giving him the Peace Prize.
Today, I state clearly and with conviction America's commitment to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons.
Fast forward 5 years, not only has the U.S. committed to upgrading delivery systems for its nuclear weapons, but it also plans on building new generation atomic bombs to replace the old ones. Upgrades are underway in major nuclear weapons plants and laboratories, and a brand new bomb replacement plant, which is said to be bigger than the Pentagon, has just been built in Kansas City.
This is not just maintaining a warhead. This is like creating a new and improved warhead. And
you can see in the future, the U.S. wants its bombs to be more accurate and fit onto different nuclear rocket launchers. The revamp of the U.S. nuclear arsenal is expected to cost $1 trillion over the next 30 years.
It doesn't make the country safer. It makes the country less safe. Why? If the United States builds a new generation of nuclear weapons, so then must Russia, so then must China. So what the U.S. does is steps higher on the escalation ladder for an arms race.
All nuclear powers, including Russia and China, are modernizing the delivery systems in their nuclear arsenals. By creating a new generation of warheads, the U.S. could fuel another arms race.
It's not easy to scrap a project that has cost your nation hundreds of billions of dollars. By investing more in new generation nuclear arsenals, governments seem to be making it that much harder for future generations to get rid of the deadly weapons. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chakyan, RT.
As we reported earlier this week, massive anti-government protests took down President Blaise Compaoré, the former head of state of the West African nation of Burkina Faso. But before protesters could celebrate their victory, a pair of military officers made a pair of competing claims to power, with Lieutenant Colonel Yakuba Isaac Zeta, the second in command of the Presidential Guard, who won the backing of other senior officers apparently in charge. But protesters have once again taken to the streets this past weekend and over the course of the past few days, facing the military in street battles during which at least one protester has been shot dead. There is an element of all of this that is not being reported in the press, and that involves President Obama's role in events in the West African nation. For more, we spoke with investigative journalist Wayne Madsen, who is also a former analyst for the U.S. National Security Agency.
What we have is a situation where a dictator took over from a very progressive leader, Thomas Sankara, in a coup d'etat. Sankara modeled himself on the Che Guevara of Africa. He basically canceled all deals between Burkina Faso and the World Bank and the IMF. That immediately put him on the radar screens for both the CIA and French intelligence. And in 1987, his deputy, Blaise Compaoré, who was the individual who was just ousted in a popular revolt,
right,
walked into his office, pulled out a gun, shot him twice, and took over power, has been in power for 27 years, and has been a very honored guest at the White House and at U.S. Receptions at the annual General Assembly Summit in New York, where he was hosted by Barack Obama.
Nice. The way he took power was sort of like a high-level version of going postal.
Yeah, basically, the Sankara, remember, 1987, we're in the middle of the Reagan administration. Right. Obama's mother is supposedly working for the World Bank, USAID, this sort of a Ford Foundation.
Right. Right.
All of this, of course, there is cover for the Central Intelligence Agency.
Right.
I mean, it was mommy that arranged to get her son
right.
a job at Business International after he graduated from Columbia, and Business International was a CIA front. So, if CIA fronts are good enough for mommy, they're good enough for Sonny Boy.
Right.
And that was certainly the case. But Ann Dunham Satoru Obama, whatever her name was, it's amazing how many passports this woman must have traveled under.
Mm.
But she spoke fluent French. She was very good at languages. She spoke fluent French. She spoke fluent Javanese, the language of the island of Java. So she was also very, very important when the CIA decided with a lot of pressure from the Reagan administration to try to overthrow Desi Bouterse, right. the left-wing leader of Suriname,
right.
who's now back in power, elected. And Obama has ordered his son arrested, Bouterse's son arrested in Panama. Was arrested on trumped-up charges brought by the DEA that he was supposedly funding Hezbollah. Like,
right.
you know, Hezbollah, by the way, is sort of our natural ally in the Middle East right now in fighting ISIL. Obama's mother was highly prized by the CIA because of her language abilities. And the French, see, she always was either in Southeast Asia or South Asia. So her presence in Ghana in 1987, at the very moment Campari walked into Thomas Sankara's office and blew him away, I think is more than just coincidental. Africa was normally not in her dossier, nor was South America, except when they needed her language skills to deal with the Suriname expatriate community in New York.
You know, there's another coincidence, or perhaps not a coincidence, in that the ultimate reacquisition by France of the neighbor Cote d'Ivoire followed what's been called the Second Civil War there, really was being staged from Burkina Faso.
Yes, well, the current president of Cote d'Ivoire, Alassane Ouattara,
yeah.
he is, of course, he's married to a French woman. French Jewish woman, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically, France prefers to have these neo-colonial leaders in charge. Ouattara's mother was from Burkina Faso, and there was a big question as to whether he was actually born in Cote d'Ivoire or Burkina Faso.
Right.
The Ivoirian constitution states that you must be like ours. You must be native born. Certainly I can see Obama has been very supportive of Ouattara because he's basically a tool of George Soros.
Right.
It was interesting. After I wrote this article about Burkina Faso, I was the subject of a Twitter campaign by a bunch of people I can only assume were Soros people, because he's heavily involved in Africa, in a lot of countries where his minions are in charge. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in Liberia, former World Bank official, is one of his people. The ex-president of Malawi, Joyce Banda, is one of his people.
Right.
So we see Soros just as involved in Africa as he has been in Eastern and Central Europe and other countries. The problem for Soros is that when the popular revolt got rid of Campare after like 48 hours of street demonstrations, the Soros people with their quote unquote civil society puppets were ready to assume power. And the person who actually assumed power is this AFRICOM, U.S. AFRICOM trainee named Isaac Zeta. And he says he's going to transition over to civil society,
right,
but he says it'll take about a year.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
They're going to have a year of a military junta,
right,
of course, supported by AFRICOM.
Right.
What they're afraid of, they don't want the Sankara people, what they call the Sankarist,
right,
to take over again, because they're gone. They remember Thomas Sankara, what he stood for, and they're going to say no to the IMF. They're going to say no to AFRICOM. They're going to kick out these U.S. intelligence and military bases,
right,
that we've established in the capital of Ouagadougou.
With a drone base, too, right?
There's a drone base there. There's also an intelligence fusion center there that was,
right,
all arranged by Campore, who had this nice friendly relationship with Mr. Obama and Michelle. He and his wife had a nice relationship with Michelle and Barack Obama. So the Sankara people, they have to. So they're using the Soros civil society people, the people who attack me on Twitter, which seems to be their new MO.
That's okay. When they send your name out on Twitter, it makes you more famous. So the hell with all that.
That's true.
It'll generate hits.
But you know, I'm sure for a lot of the people in the Soros and Soros operations, they had to go look for a map and find
right
out where Burkina Faso was. First of all,
yeah, right.
One thing Sankara did is the country had been a French neo-colonial backwater. It was called Upper Volta, and Sankara, of course, changed its name to the more, you know, indigenous sounding name of Burkina Faso.
Right. That whole region has certainly caught an awful lot of attention from the United States, and just about everything that happens on the ground there means that we need to deploy more troops there, whether it's civil unrest in this place, terrorist attacks there, or even disease. Because the region has seen the introduction of U.S. troops over the Ebola outbreak. And chances are, I can't imagine, I mean, you could ask the Japanese this, but once they arrive, do they ever go home?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the three countries where the Ebola hot zones first developed, it started with a two-year-old a girl who contracted it, the disease, in Meliandu, which is in Guinea, near where the borders of Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea converge. It's not very far from the Salandu iron ore range in Guinea. And of course, one of the richest guys in Israel named Benny Steinmetz was trying to grab a hold of that iron ore mining region. But the current president of Guinea, Alpha Conde, found out that Steinmetz had been paying bribes to his predecessor for these mining rights, and he canceled the contract. Actually, the U.S. Justice Department investigated Steinmetz for violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, because Steinmetz has operations in the United States as well. But all that seems to have been forgotten about since the outbreak of Ebola. There's been a total reduction in the ability of local governments in Guinea and Liberia and Sierra Leone to govern. And in that type of situation, it's perfect for mercenaries and these unscrupulous businessmen, most of whom are Israelis in that region, to come in there and not to make light of the term, they basically rape these countries of their natural resources.
Right. Yeah. And what's interesting, you know, you mentioned maps. If you actually look at a map, the West African coast up to Southwest Asia and Ukraine, and look at that, pretend that you're in a war room, and look at that with the various wars that are going on, the U.S. military operations that are going on there, you can see that if Burkina Faso was lost from the control of the United States, that their recent acquisition by AFRICOM, you know, the deployment of troops to into Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone, the French into Cote d'Ivoire, Burkina Faso kind of blocks them from going into the interior of Africa, with the exception of Mali, of course, which is next to it.
Yeah.
And has, you know, even though it's a landlocked country, it has a strategic position just based on geography.
Right, and we saw the U.S. basically, with the French getting involved in Mali, when the Tuareg people in northern Mali decided to, become independent after another U.S. AFRICOM trainee took over the Mali government in a coup d'etat. And then we went in there and with the French and tried to put down this Tuareg secessionist movement. Now, the Tuaregs were on the radar screen of the Pentagon because they had been very supportive of Colonel Gaddafi in Libya and vice versa.
Right.
And of course, many Tuaregs found work up in Libya during Gaddafi's rule there.
That's right.
But after he was overthrown, we saw all these Islamist groups funded by the Saudis, and I believe by the Israelis. I think that's pretty common knowledge now that the Israelis supported them in eastern Libya and Benghazi,
for sure.
And also are supporting ISIL. Because when Muslims kill Muslims and Africans kill Africans and Arabs kill Arabs, that's good for Israeli businessmen who go in there like Steinmetz and take advantage of these situations.
Yeah, and by the way, U.S. multinationals who take the major advantage. What do you think are the prospects for, what would be the mechanical process that the people would have to go through there, given the various forces that are at play in Burkina Faso? To achieve what they started when they went in the streets a couple of weeks ago.
Well, I mean, ideally, Sankara's children and wife that managed to escape to France and not they didn't suffer the consequences of the coup. One of the leading opposition parties is the Sankara's party. Right. It is led by a relative of Sankara. Who is the leader of that party, and it has served as the attorney for the family because the family would like to see justice too, because Mrs. Sankara's husband was killed, and the Sankara's children, his children saw their father. They didn't see their father killed, but they'd like to bring charges. Like the United States wants to support all these human rights violation charges against these others, but it's very silent when it comes to when the CIA does something nefarious,
kidding.
What they did in 1987, especially when it seemed to have involved Mrs. Sotoro Obama Dunham. There'd be free elections there, and the Sankara's party would take control and try to implement some of the policies that Thomas Sankara advocated. And yes, they're absolutely progressive and left wing in nature, but it's to get Burkina Faso out from under this neo-colonial yoke that's been imposed on it by this military regime over 27 years, supported by the World Bank, IMF, now under the military boot of AFRICOM.
And then, just for speculation purposes, assuming that left-wing government comes to power in Burkina Faso, what do you think are the prospects for the people on the ground in Cote d'Ivoire, who in the main supported Gbagbo, and with Burkina Faso now flipping sides, of them being able to throw off the French again?
Right. Well, I think that would it would be encouraging to people in Cote d'Ivoire, those who supported the socialist President Gbagbo against this current almost considered a usurper, Ouattara.
He's a viceroy.
although the problem with Cote d'Ivoire is that it doesn't have a real history of progressive rule like Burkina Faso does. I mean, for years it was under the dictatorship of Félix Houphouët-Boigny, who changed the capital to Yamoussoukro from Abidjan, and then built this immense presidential palace that was larger than St. Peter's Basilica in Rome.
Well, he's got a big family.
He had a big family. Well, apparently he did. Anyway, the Burkina Faso being restored to its somewhat 1987 policy alignment would, I think, encourage people all over the region to throw off this. As a matter of fact, many of these dictators are worried right now after they saw Campari thrown out in 48 hours. But you see, it was the same thing. The Soros people tried to glom onto that like they did with the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt and other places. And it didn't, it didn't quite work out that way for them. So, of course, AFRICOM had to step in and put one of their the guys that was trained by the Special Operations Command in Tampa, Florida, in charge. And he says he's going to be in there for about a year. It's pretty hard to get rid of these junta's once they take over, unless there's immense pressure brought to bear on them internationally. I don't see that happen with him being a him being a foot soldier for AFRICOM. But I see what's happening in Burkina Faso, the same thing that's happening in South Yemen, where the Houthis have taken over the central government in Sana'a, but the South Yemenis, who remember when South Yemen was the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, a very secular and Marxist government, are trying to restore their independence that was stolen from them in 1990.
Right, that's right.
And there we would, if they were to return to a secular socialist government, the United States would lose that coveted base in Aden, which they've always tried to, the USS Cole found out that it's not a very good port if the guy's coming alongside. But anyway, be that as it may,
very bad visibility there, right?
Exactly. the issue is that the U.S. Now with this Republican Congress, of course, we're going to try to extend this neo-imperial rule around the world. But we're so overextended now. I think we're going to see, hopefully, a lot of these countries where popular revolutions were suppressed have their popular forms of government restored, whether it's in Burkina Faso or South Yemen or, what we see going on in Latin America. That they seem to have staying power now, those governments there, especially in Uruguay, where the leftist candidate who's going to replace Mujica, Vasquez, looks like he's ahead in the election.
Yeah, I think so too. Wayne Madsen, thank you very much, and we'll speak with you again soon.
Good to join you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.